on Friday, and I start having me a ball, 'cause I got a good feeling, and I don't feel no pain at all. Friday's my day.
Good evening, everybody. Malloy here on Second Thought Radio Network. Hey, how you doing? I'll tell you, I would love to be at this collection of geeks and freaks meeting in D.C., the CPAC convention, with a huge backpack full of, two great big tanks like Tom DeLay used to do, the Bugman. Tom DeLay used to be an exterminator in, Dallas, someplace. That's how he got so crazy, sucking in all those chemicals all those years. But I would like to have one of those double tank backpacks with a spray nozzle on it and just walk through this place. Fill up the room with a cloud of, toxic gas, the kind that kills roaches. But since I can't do that, it's more fun to just get little snippets and videos and YouTube stuff that is coming out of there. This is the conservative movement. Oh my God! This crazy woman from Minnesota, Michelle Bachmann, who honest to God, I can't think of any member of Congress in the recent past. Unless it was the other crazy woman from Florida, the one who was the former Secretary of State. What was her name, Kathy? Catherine Harris, yeah. She was a wacko, too. But Michelle Bachmann is, oh, my God, she's a laugh a minute. She was emceeing today, and there was an introduction of Michael Steele, the new head of the Republican Party, and he was introduced at the head table, and he stood up, and oh my goodness, look, he's an African American. Well, you would think everybody would know that by this point, including Michelle Bachmann. But anyway, so he waved and grinned and sat down, and all the white people there were just clapping and cheering because they had a nice black man as the new head of their party. And then Michelle Bachmann turns kind of to her right and looks at him and says, Michael Steele, the new head of our party, you be the man. You be the man, Michael. You be the man. Ah! She's going to try to talk Negro. Oh, my God. You be the man. Coming from this white lady from Minnesota. You be the man. Ah. Oh, I've said it before, I'll say it again. This is another one of these instances where I am just ashamed to be in the same racial group as Michelle Bachmann. You be the man. Ooh, you eat some chicken over there, Michael? Is that what you be doing? You be the man? Oh. You want to see it see a digital recording of this? Watch the rebroadcast of, if you live here in the East and I think in Central times, and watch the rebroadcast of Keith Olbermann tonight towards the end of the program. Oh my God, I just can't believe this. You beat a man from Michelle Bachmann. You beat a man. Oh, good. Okay, let's move on to the real negative, nasty stuff here. I'm sorry, Prairie, too, but it's kind of fallen on your shoulders to just, be the messenger. We don't shoot the messenger here. But anyway, Prairie, too, wrote in. Subject line is wealth tax, sort of, taxing the wealthy in this country. New York Times had a great article today, front page article, more of an opinion piece, about how Barack Obama has decided to throw into the garbage what never should have happened to this country, and that was Reaganomics. It has taken 25 years, 29 years, to get rid of this. And in the process, it took somebody like Barack Obama to do it. An honest Democrat. Not Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton was not a Democrat. But The end of Reaganomics, finally, which was the old trickle down idea of cut all the taxes for all the wealthy people, and let the rest of us just wallow around down here, trying our goddamnedest to make a living, to pay for health care, to meet our mortgage payments, and unbelievable what they did to us. Okay, well, the shoe is on the other foot now. And this wealthy top 1 or 2%, if you listen real close, listen, shh, 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 listen. You hear that squealing? Listen. There it is. You hear that squealing? Like pigs? Like pigs going to slaughter? That's the wealthy in this country. And now all the Republicans are screaming, class warfare! Class warfare! How come it's only class warfare when the target is the wealthy? Why isn't it class warfare when the wealthy decide to rape and pillage everybody else? Why is that called upward mobility or trickle down or the American way or the free market, right? When they're on top smashing their feet on the rest of us, that's never called class warfare. But let somebody like Obama raise the upper tax bracket from 36 or 35% up to 39. Class warfare! And who's doing the screaming? Well, the people who in media who this is going to affect, right? All these overpaid sausage-headed bastards who now all of a sudden, we have to. And they're throwing every cockeyed lie out there they can come up with about Obama's tax measures. Now, if you want the straight story, and I know a lot of you don't, because you listen to this program, you right-wing skunks. But for normal people who listen to this program, the best readable, understandable for folks like me, and I would imagine I'm like you, report on this is to go to today's New York Times. You can get there online, right? And take a look at the breakdown, especially the tax situation, healthcare situation, just on and on. This is amazing stuff. Is it everything that we want? No. Just like his announcement today, and we'll have some sound from that about the pullout of troops from Iraq. Is it what we liberals on the left really want? No. The result is what we want. But, you know, you and I, since we're liberals and we have been beaten about the head and shoulders for so long now, over two decades, that we want everything to happen instantly. Well, it's not. And we got to understand that it's not going to happen instantly. But I think Obama is trying. He's still doing the rope-a-dope thing. He's still pulling these dumb bastards in slowly but surely. And also, I got an explanation for you now, thanks to Spitfire, of why this case came up about the telecoms and why the Obama administration took the position that it did, that we were kind of flummoxed about the other night and nonplussed and sitting here going, what? Well, Jesus, what? I think we have an explanation for it. We'll get to that tonight, too. So we got a lot of ground to cover. Oh, Prairie 2. I'm sorry, Prairie 2. Well, stretch if you have to here, okay? All right, this is what he writes today. New unemployment claims continued its march toward 700,000 last week, a number that seems to have surprised the analysts who yet again predicted a modest decline. Capital goods orders are down more than 20% from last year. Today we find out that the GDP turns out to be contracting much faster than previously reported. Exports are down 24%, and we have the worst decline in consumer spending in 28 years. Retail stores continue to close in record numbers despite the efforts of landlords who own the malls to keep them in business, reversing a 30-year trend. Malls are even reducing hours in order to cut costs for their tenants. Whew. The hypothesis of the new so-called service economy, or Reaganomics, was that jobs could be, quote, created, end quote, by shifting the middle class, who used to create wealth by making things, into new low-paying service jobs and make up for the difference in income by loaning everybody money. The service jobs are now disappearing faster than the glaciers in the newly tropical Arctic, since all the wealth has been extracted from the middle class, causing credit to dry up, you now have a huge glut of goods competing for a declining number of dollars. Creating even more debt to keep the economy going may seem counterintuitive, but it transfers wealth back to the middle class, since they benefit from the spending and the tax burden is being shifted to the super wealthy who drained it from the economy to begin with. There's still a long list of things that need to be done to fix the mess, but this is a start. Prairie 2. Now, hear what he said. Creating even more debt, which is what this first budget is doing, to keep the economy going may seem counterintuitive, but it transfers wealth back to us, the middle class, since the wealthy people in this country have been sticking it in us and breaking it off for 28 years. And this is what the right-wingers call class warfare. Oh, the Democrats are making class warfare. Oh, goddamn, they're making class warfare.
Everything is crumbling around me. Why does everything cost so much money? Could somebody please help out my family? My mom needs hearing aids, new shoulders and new legs. My dad needs a break, he works all day every day. My brother needs a place and a job where he can make enough money to take care of his baby.
Not ready to make nice. It's Mike Malloy.
Past the hour. Ed in Albuquerque sent this in. Mike, right-wing conservatives are fond of saying that left-wing liberals have a new messiah in Barack Hussein Obama. I've never agreed with this, but just for fun, let's examine this claim further. Scripture says that at the end of days, mankind would have to endure 7 years of horrible events, such as wars, famine, pestilence, and the like, after which would come the return of Christ, who would do battle with the Antichrist and defeat him. Since the attacks of September 11, 2001, mankind has endured exactly the kinds of calamities talked about in the book of Revelation. And it was 7 years from September 11, 2001 to November 2008 when Barack Hussein Obama did battle with the Republican Party and defeated them. Now, if Barack Hussein Obama is Christ, if he has returned to right the wrongs here on earth, it stands to reason that the religious right would be happy about that. Instead, they are angry and fearful. Perhaps that's what they mean when they say they are God-fearing people. But why be angry? Could it be that if Barack Obama is the Messiah, then the religious right would have to admit that Christ is a man of color, that he is black and not white, as they all believe? They certainly are hung up on the idea that he was not born in America, Obama. Where was he born then? Bethlehem? Christ was not treated very well by mankind the last time he was here on earth. How will we treat him the next time he arrives? This is all very heady stuff and in many ways ridiculous. But no more ridiculous than some of the claims the religious right nut jobs are making about our president. God gave us all brains. We should use them. Ed in Albuquerque. That's interesting, Ed. Wouldn't that be funny, huh? Here he is again. Last time he was a dark-skinned carpenter who threw the money changers out of the temple, this man Jesus. Now, I'm not stipulating his divinity at all. He was just a cool cat who wandered around the Middle East 2,000 years ago, if he really did wander around the Middle East 2,000 years ago, with 12 guys. A couple of whom were probably gay, and they had a radical message, and, you know, yada, yada, yada. But what they do to him last time, they, Rome couldn't stand it. So they crucified him, murdered him. All right. So here we have another a dark-skinned man. Never mind. Barack Hussein, Jesus Obama. Huh? It's getting weirder and weirder and weirder. This is weird, too. This is from John in San Antonio, Texas. Mike, I spent a lot of time in Nacogdoches, Texas. I think it is perfectly legitimate and accurate to describe that town as nowhere, in the middle of nowhere. The town is 150 miles or so northeast of Houston and 30 miles or so west of the Louisiana border. The main transportation arteries in the area are Tulane. The economy is based on chickens and pulpwood. The last few days, Chinese businessmen have been going door to door and making absurd offers for local businesses. I have this directly from a local restaurant owner. Nacogdoches is now on the itinerary for Chinese purchasing tours? What the hell is going on? Freaked out, John, San Antonio, Texas. Probably just scouting out places for Chinese restaurants. Oh, you want fortune cookie? We come here from China. We're here to open a restaurant. Hey! Oh, God. So the people, you know, Nacogdoches, Texas, what? What that boy say? I can't understand a word he's saying. What the hell is he saying? Huh! I can't understand what you're saying. What are you saying? Is place for sale? What place? What the hell are you talking about? I don't know. I don't know what's going on either. Just trying to buy up some property here in Texas, or over in Texas, right? We'll be back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
No more Mr. Nice Guy. Here's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. I just can't get over Michelle Bachmann turning around from the podium at the this convocation of freaks and geeks in D.C. and looking at Michael Steele, the black man who has been pushed up to be the head of the Republican National Committee. And Michelle Bachmann looks at him and says, "You the man! Hey, Michael, you the man! Go ahead, Michelle. Talk Negro. Go ahead. Do it again. You the man." Even somebody like Steele, who has become probably the most focused House Negro in the history of the Republican Party, even he, when he got home today, he probably just sat there for a few minutes and poured himself a little bit of a drink and sat down and thought to himself, "You the man? You the man? What is that white bitch trying to do? You the man? Damn." But that's Michelle Bachmann, and that's a Republican. Hey, this is kind of an interesting story. It's from the Bangor Daily News in Maine, from Belfast, Maine. This guy, James Cummings, who police say was shot to death by his wife about 2 months ago, it's reported he had a cache of radioactive materials in his home suitable for building a dirty bomb. According to an FBI field intelligence report from the Washington Regional Threat and Analysis Center, posted online by WikiLeaks, an organization that posts leaked documents, an investigation into the case revealed that radioactive materials were removed from James Cummings' home after he was shot to death on December 9th. The report posted at the WikiLeaks website states that, quote, on 9 December 2008, radiological dispersal device components and literature and radioactive materials were discovered in the main residence of an identified deceased person, James Cummings. The report goes on to say that 4 1-gallon containers of 35% hydrogen peroxide, uranium, thorium, lithium metal, thermite, aluminum powder, beryllium, boron, black iron oxide, and magnesium ribbon were found in the home. Also found was literature on how to build dirty bombs and information about cesium-137, strontium-90, and cobalt-60, radioactive materials all. Now, the FBI report also stated there was evidence linking James Cummings to white supremacist groups. No! Really? This would seem to confirm observations by local tradesmen. Now, what I'm quoting for you is out of the Bangor Daily News newspaper. Local tradesmen who worked at the Cummings home, you know, like plumbers and carpenters, who said he was an ardent admirer of Adolf Hitler and had a collection of Nazi memorabilia around the house, including a prominently displayed flag with swastika. The now-dead Cummings claimed to have pieces of Hitler's personal silverware and place settings, according to a painter, a house painter who was there a few days after the shooting. The report went on and stated that the uranium component was bought online from a U.S. company that was identified in the investigation, but not in the report that is now online. State police have identified Amber Cummings as the person who shot James Cummings. The couple's 9-year-old daughter was present the morning of the shooting in what police have described as a domestic violence homicide. Amber Cummings, the wife, who is her former wife now, the widow, who is staying in the Belfast, Maine area, has not been charged in the crime, in the case, although the Waldo County Grand Jury, currently meeting in Belfast, could take up the matter during its session this week. State police have acknowledged that the 29-year-old Cummings, the dude, was killed by a gunshot. However, the results of the autopsy have been impounded, as have the search warrants executed at Cummings High Street home following the shooting. Authorities spent days searching the house, according to neighbors. Lieutenant Gary Wright, who heads up the Maine State Police Criminal Investigation Division team working the case, declined to comment. Stephen McCausland, spokesman for the Maine Department of Public Safety, declined to comment. Maine Deputy Attorney General William Stokes declined to comment. David Farmer, spokesman for Governor John Baldacci, said Tuesday it was inappropriate for the governor to comment. A spokesman for U.S. Senator Susan Collins' staff said there was no one able to comment. Telephone messages left with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security were not returned. Whoa, talk about drawing a veil over a, well, you know, it is an ongoing investigation, right? I have to say, first of all, I don't know what's going to happen, but congratulations to Amber Cummings for killing the son of a bitch. A, B, one less right-wing neo-Nazi white supremacist Republican freak in the United States means the air is a little bit, tiny bit cleaner tonight. Oh, by the way, you may find this, the whole story is interesting, but the dead guy, Cummings, grew up in California and lived in Texas before moving to Maine in August 2007. He was wealthy. The actual source of his wealth was a trust fund established by his father, a prominent landowner in the Northern California city of Fort Bragg. Ding, 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 ding. Fort Bragg? We know about Fort Bragg, California, don't we? It's isn't that the homegrown marijuana capital of the known universe? Anyway, an internet search of the James B. Cummings Trust Fund indicated that it had an annual income of $10 million. Annual income of God only knows what the body of the trust was. What? $100 million? $150 million? Fort Bragg, California, huh? Not to be confused with Fort Bragg, North Carolina, of course. I spent a month in Fort Bragg one night. Oh. Interesting story. Well, Amber Cumming, I hope you get off on justifiable homicide, because apparently this guy was an abusive son of a bitch. And you know, I truly believe that after a woman has had enough of physical, psychological, emotional abuse, she should pick up the nearest weapon and put a bullet right between the son of a bitch's eyes. I mean, end of story. And that it should be justifiable homicide. No question, no doubt, no argument, no nothing. Right? Ugh. the attack on by mainstream media on Barack Obama's plans is just unending. We have a couple of sound bites for you. CNBC host Maria Bartiromo, who so many people in the who watch television, the financial news, just think she walks on water. She was on the Morning Joe program, you know, the one hosted by the Nazi couple. Neo-Nazi couple. They're not real Nazis like Pat Buchanan and his sister, but the neo-Nazis, which would be Joe, what's his name? God, I'm drawing a complete blank. And poor Mika Brzezinski, who has, you talk about somebody suffering from, Joe Scarborough, you talk about somebody suffering from Stockholm syndrome. Poor Mika Brzezinski has just been beaten into a pulp mentally right before her eyes. She sucks up to Joe now like he is her, I don't know, protector and big brother. She's the other day on the program, she was sporting a Palin button. But I digress. During the February 26th edition of this program, CNBC host Maria, this is from Media Matters, Maria Bartiromo asserted that among the, quote, unintended consequences, unquote, of Obama's proposal to let the Bush tax cuts on wealthy taxpayers expire is that, quote, this is from Maria, the bottom line is small businesses are putting $250,000 in revenue out there, and they're going to get impacted, and this is the single largest creator of jobs. Let's listen. Willie Geist is talking, and then Maria Bartiromo.
We're just getting a report that the forecast deficit for $1.75 trillion, that's 12% of GDP, the largest since World War II. And Maria, you have some concerns.
Well, I think that it is extraordinary that we are talking about raising taxes in this severe, severe environment. You know, I think Andrea is right by saying people are willing to pay taxes. They recognize that this is an extraordinary moment in time. Having said that, there are such unintended consequences in this. First of all, charitable contributions, get ready for those to go off a cliff, because you are not going to get the tax write-off that you got in terms of, you know, charitable contributions. Next thing, $250,000. Look, the bottom line is small businesses, you know, are putting $250,000 in revenue out there, and they're going to get impacted. And this is the single largest creator of jobs.
Well, the suggestion that Obama has proposed taxing small business revenue is utterly and absolutely false. In fact, Obama has proposed raising marginal income tax rates and reducing income tax deductions for individuals earning more than $200,000 per year and for couples earning more than $250,000 per year. And further, Bartiromo's suggestion that if this goes through, doing so would be a tax increase for most small businesses is patently false. As Media Matters for America documented, according to the Tax Policy Center's table of 2007 tax returns that reported small business income, 481,000 of those returns, about 2%, are in the top two income tax brackets, which include all filers with taxable incomes that would be affected. That means 98% of small businesses would not be affected. So Bartiromo's suggestion that Obama's proposal would tax the revenues of small business owners advances a false talking point from the 2000 campaign about then-Senator Obama's proposal to increase taxes on those making more than $250,000. This is what's going on. Oh, there's more. I've got some more for you. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy.
With my New York brim and my gold tooth display, nobody give me trouble, cause they know I got it made. I'm bad. I'm nationwide. Girl, I'm bad, 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 bad. I'm nationwide.
Standing up to the flying monkey right, it's Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. Okay, that was Maria Bartiromo and this poor Geist, what's his first name? Willie. Now, to the Today Show from yesterday. Mary Madeline was on. She was on Dick Cheney's staff. I don't know how the Raging Cajun was able to stay married to her. This is a woman who worked for a killer, a torturer, like Dick Cheney. Oh, well, you know, who knows what holds marriages together. But Mary Madeline was on the Today Show, and she was being interviewed by Meredith Vieira, the co-host. And she claimed that Louisiana Governor Bob Paiush Jindal had made more progress in Louisiana in the shortest period of time in the history of the state, probably in the country. And she went on to claim that education reform and ethics reform, everything that put Louisiana down in scale, is now one of the top states in the country. And, of course, Madeline, as most Republicans do, cited no evidence in support of her suggestion that Louisiana is now one of the top states in the country in education, all due to Paiush's education reform since he became governor a year ago. In fact, as the Louisiana Department of Education stated in a January 7 press release titled Quality Counts 2009, the, quote, 13th edition of Education Week's series of annual report cards tracking state education policies and outcomes found that, in the department's words, in Louisiana, gains were minimal since the previous report, and that in overall rank, Louisiana dropped from 21st last year to 35th this year. Indeed, in two of the three broad categories in which states in the District of Columbia were graded in quality counts, Louisiana ranked in the bottom five. That's in the past year, the same period of time that Paiush Jindal has been the governor. So Mary Madeline, another right-wing goddamn liar who puts this stuff out there. Thank God for Media Matters, who tracks them and provides the audio. This is Meredith Vieira.
You know, you talk about a united Republican Party, but I want to read to you something that David Brooks said. Now, he's a conservative columnist. This was after Governor Bobby Jindal gave the response to President Obama's speech on Tuesday. Brooks said, to come up at this moment in history with a stale government is the problem, we can't trust the federal government, is just a disaster for the Republican Party. The country is in a panic right now. And he went on to suggest that the party is out of touch with where this country is and where it is headed. So you do not agree with what he said?
No, I don't. And I live in Louisiana now, as you know, and Bobby Jindal is an extraordinary public servant. He's the greatest public policy innovator in the country today. And that isn't what he said. That's a David Brooks rendition of it, who's a friend. But Bobby Jindal has made more progress in Louisiana in the shortest period of time in the history of the state and probably in the country. Education reform, and ethics reform.
Right.
Everything that put Louisiana downscale is now in one of the top states in the country. What
really?
People were objecting to about Governor Jindal's presentation was the presentation itself. And, you know, demonstrably, he was much stronger on Meet the Press and much stronger on the Today Show than he was in front of a teleprompter. I think if you want to take the measure of the man, I'd rather see him be able to go up against you than stand in front of a teleprompter.
But, you know, Mary, it wasn't just that. It was, again, conservatives were criticizing him for stale ideas. He didn't say anything. Nothing new.
No, these are not stale ideas. These are the essence of the fiscal conservatism upon which this country was founded and prospered, and he is applying in the state of Louisiana.
Oh, my God. You see? You see how this works? And America sits out here in the morning and absorbs some of this, or not, and it sticks, or not. Well, Mary Madeline pointed out to the world that Bobby Jindal, Paiush, has taken the state of Louisiana way up in rankings in education, when the exact opposite is true. Paiush has reduced Louisiana from 21st to 35th this year in overall rank in terms of education. 21st to 35th. And in two of the three broad categories in which, regarding education, which states in the District of Columbia were graded, Louisiana ranked in the bottom five. But Mary Madeline can sit there and claim that Paiute did this wonderful job. Oh, my God. And speaking of Paiute, you know that his claim about meeting with Louisiana Sheriff Harry Lee during Hurricane Katrina was another lie. It never happened the way, not even close to the way he described it. We'll have that for you after the break. We'll get to that in a few minutes. This one, though, I want you to hear this. After Obama's speech today about, and we're going to have some sound from that for you about withdrawing troops, NBC's David Gregory introduced or interviewed General Barry McCafferty. And I want you to hear how he introduces him. Listen to this.
As we watch the president work the rope line at Camp Lejeune, I want to bring in now retired Army four-star General Barry McCaffrey. General McCaffrey is an MSNBC military analyst and is also on the board of directors for DynCorps, an organization that's helping train local forces in Afghanistan.
There you go. That's the first time that Barry McCaffrey has been identified as sitting on the board of a weapons manufacturing company, DynCorps, one of the leading. Credit to David Gregory for saying that, but hold on just a second. David Gregory never would have said that had it not been for the piece in April in the New York Times last April by investigative reporter David Barstow. And that report, if you remember, detailed the connections between media military analysts like Barry McCaffrey and the Pentagon and defense industries. And McCaffrey, as a matter of fact, was named as one of numerous military analysts who, quote, have ties to military contractors vested in the very war policies they are asked to assess on air, end quote. Barstow reported that McCaffrey had his own consulting firm and sat on the boards of major military contractors. Oh, this stuff. So I don't know whether to give David Gregory credit for introducing him that way instead of saying MSNBC. We'll be back right after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back. 6 and a half past the hour, the Malloy program on Second Thought Radio Network. All right, I want to play that for you again. David Gregory, we just played the little bit there where David Gregory, preparing to interview General Barry McCaffrey, actually identifies him as a board member of DynCorps. That's not because MSNBC or NBC, which is owned by General Electric, another major weapons manufacturer, that's not because David Gregory has gotten religion. It is because of the investigative reporter David Barstow detailing the connections between media military analysts and the Pentagon about a year ago, the military analysts in the Pentagon and defense industries. And McCaffrey was named as one of numerous military analysts who have ties to military contractors who obviously are vested in the very war policies that these guys are brought on to assess on the program. Following the Times article, by the way, Media Matters for America conducted a review of appearances between January 2002 and May 2008 by military analysts named in the article, including McCaffrey, and identified more than 600 appearances by McCaffrey on NBC, MSNBC, and CNBC. And, of course, there was a follow-up to the article. Back in November, David Barstow, the investigative reporter for the New York Times, wrote that McCaffrey, quote, has immersed himself in businesses that have grown with the fight against terrorism. And Barstow highlighted a June 28, 2005 NBC News special report anchored by Brian Williams in which McCaffrey said, quote, the Iraqi forces, security forces are real, end quote. But neither Brian Williams nor McCaffrey disclosed his ties to DynCorp, the company that trained those forces, or to DynCorp's parent company, Veritas Capital. According to investigative reporter Barstow, Barry McCaffrey served on DynCorp's board of directors at the time and owned special stock that allowed him to share in DynCorp's profits, which, by the way, were up 87% that year, largely because of the Iraq War. An investigative reporter, Barstow, further reported that McCaffrey, quote, has earned at least $500,000 for his work on the so-called advisory council of Veritas Capital. And people wonder why media always presents these people, generals, retired, who, if they have had combat experience, the real combat experience, upper rank officers, are as anti-war as you can possibly become, unless you get somebody like Barry McCaffrey, who makes money at it, for Christ's sake. Now, let's listen to the whole David Gregory. It's only 56 seconds. And listen again to Gregory's introduction, where he identifies for the first time who Barry McCaffrey really is.
As we watch the president work the rope line at Camp Lejeune, I want to bring in now retired Army four-star general Barry McCaffrey. General McCaffrey is an MSNBC military analyst and is also on the board of directors for DynCorp, an organization that's helping train local forces in Afghanistan.
An organization?
MSNBC military analyst, retired Army Colonel Jack Jacobs. General McCaffrey, I'll start with you. Reaction to what you heard?
Well, you know, I think it's almost overwhelming the degree to which he connected with the military audience. This was straightforward. It was coherent. I didn't see any wiggle room about ending the war. The statement about ending combat operations has some some room for him to negotiate a different force level. But the end of 2011, he says, we're out. So, again, I thought it was encouraging, sensible, and a feasible way ahead.
Well, good for you. Good for you, Barry. Now, let me focus on David Gregory for just a second. On Meet the Press last Sunday, David Gregory was sticking up for bank stockholders. And this is what Gregory said. There's a larger point here, which is, first of all, the more the shares of these banks gets talked down, you know, Barack Obama is supposed to be talking them down, you see, the closer you get to wiping out the shareholder completely. And it's not clear to me that everybody understands that the investor in this country, who is not just a fat cat, the investor is us. It's the taxpayer. It's the teacher. It's someone who's invested in a 401k. The investors on the sidelines, scared to death about taking any risk, and unless that changes, the economy really can't turn around. Well, okay, but this is like Limbaugh. Matthew Iglesias writes today, the other day for Fair.org, on the oddity of Gregory making a distinction between so-called fat cats and people like himself. It's not available, Gregory's salary, but his NBC colleague Chris Matthews reportedly makes $5 million a year. That's the Washington Post reported that. Tim Russert made $5 million a year. Washington Post reported that. So Gregory's salary is probably in that neighborhood. That's 100 times the median family income in the United States, not counting Gregory's spouse's income. What does she do? She used to be a vice president at Fannie Mae. How much does she make? $3 million a year. Now, on Gregory's actual point, where he said only about a third of stocks are owned in the U.S. by the wealthiest 1%, it's true that not all stockholders are actually fat cats. But almost 90% of stocks are owned by the top 20% of income getters in this country. So when you're talking about policies that benefit stockholders, you're talking about benefiting a distinct minority. The upper 20%, the upper 10%, the upper 3%. This is Reaganomics, and this is what Barack Obama is trying to end. But when you are opposed, even by people like Maria Bartiromo, who is on a business network, David Gregory, the list goes on and on. I mean, if you ever want to really see isolated some of the comments these people are making, because it all just flies by in a blur. Some of it sticks in our unconscious mind, some doesn't. Go to MediaMatters.org or go to Fair.org and look at some of the video clips they have there. Now, Bobby Jindal, our good friend Piyush. Piyush Jindal. He, in his rebuttal the other night to his rebuttal to Obama's speech, Jindal made a false claim about meeting with Louisiana Sheriff Harry Lee during Hurricane Katrina. So Piyush is just another Republican liar. Actually, the meeting never happened. Listen to this.
Let me tell you a story.
Okay.
During Katrina, I visited Sheriff Harry Lee, a Democrat and a good friend of mine. When I walked into his makeshift office, I had never seen him so angry. He was literally yelling into the phone. Well, I'm the sheriff, and if you don't like it, you can come and arrest me. I asked him, Sheriff, what's got you so mad? He told me that he put out a call for volunteers to come with their boats to rescue people who were trapped on their rooftops by the floodwaters.
Uh-huh.
The boats were all lined up and ready to go.
Uh-huh.
And then some bureaucrat showed up and told them they couldn't go out in the water unless they had proof of insurance and registration.
Huh.
And I told him, Sheriff, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Before I knew it, he was yelling on the phone, Congressman Jindal is here, and he says you can come and arrest him too. There he just told those boaters, ignore the bureaucrats and go start rescuing people.
Hot damn.
There's a lesson in this experience.
What's that?
The strength of America is not found in our government.
Really?
It's found in the compassionate hearts and the enterprising spirit of our citizens.
That's right. So when a massive hurricane hits, the levees break, all hell breaks loose, people are dying, and the federal government does nothing. That's a moment of opportunity, right, Piyush? Yeah, that's a moment of grand opportunity. All right, now's the truth. This is from... Is it from Media Matters or from Daily Coast or from TPM Muckraker? Let's just do it this way. In the last few days, first Daily Coast and then TPM Muckraker raised serious questions about that whole story, based in part on the fact that no news reports that could be found placed Piyush in the affected area at the specific time at issue. He was about 75 miles away. Piyush had described being in the office of Sherry Lee during Katrina and hearing him yelling into the phone at a government bureaucrat who was refusing to let him send volunteer boats out to rescue stranded storm victims because they didn't have the necessary permits. Jindal said he told Lee, that's ridiculous, which prompted Lee to tell the bureaucrat that the rescue effort should go ahead. Or the bureaucrat come and arrest Lee and Jindal. But now, a Jindal spokeswoman has admitted to Politico that in reality, Jindal overheard Lee talking about the episode to someone else by phone days later. The Jindal spokeswoman said she thought Sheriff Lee, who died conveniently, I guess, in 2007, that Lee was being interviewed about the incident at the time. Now, this is not a minor difference. Jindal's presence in Lee's office during the crisis itself was a key element of the story's intended appeal, putting him, Piyush, at the center of the action during the maelstrom. Just as important, Piyush implied that his support for the sheriff helped ensure the rescue went ahead. But it turns out that Piyush wasn't there and played no role in making the rescue happen. And there's a larger point here, too. The central anecdote of the Republicans' primetime response to Obama's speech, intended to illustrate the threat of excessive government regulation, turns out to have been a lie. But we're not surprised about that at all, are we, truth seekers? This is what Republicans do. And didn't you know it, if you watched any of that, and, you know, I said the other night when we carried a Barack Obama speech live, I said, we're not going to carry any of this freakish Piyush Jindal's response for obvious reasons. But I cheated during the breaks. I listened to a little bit of it during the commercial breaks, and I heard him tell that story, and I thought to myself, what? Well, something here doesn't ring true. Well, actually, none of it was true.
I'm so carefree with a joyless heart. Then sometimes again it seems all I have is.
Better stand back. Here come 50,000 watts of free speech. It's Mike Malloy.
Well, it may not be free, but it's certainly reasonable, right? The reports are starting to come in now. New York Times is talking about how the people who are unemployed, and here in Georgia the number is rapidly approaching 9%. And if you looked at the real numbers, the ones that are not fudged by the Department of Labor Statistics, we probably crossed 9% several months ago. But you know how the numbers can be manipulated, right? No state wants to say, oh, well, look, we have 12% unemployed. But governors in nine states now, mostly here in the South, are... You've heard them. They're talking about rejecting millions of dollars in this federal stimulus money for increased unemployment insurance. That sure makes sense, doesn't it? These sons of bitches. All of a sudden, there's starting to be growing anger among the ranks of the jobless in these states that obviously they could be left out of a significant government benefit. I've even heard governors of states now saying, hey, listen, if Georgia doesn't want the money, give it to us. We'll take it. These idiots. The stimulus bill that was passed by Congress and signed into law includes incentives to states to expand benefits to many more jobless people than the ones who are eligible to get it now, including part-time workers and those who have cycled in and out of the workforce who are not covered in many states. Now, the Republican governors of Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, and Texas, oh, Jesus, along with Alaska and Idaho, all those governors have said, well, you know, expanding those incentives could eventually require us to raise taxes. Now, that's simply not true, because if they change the law to give these extra money, this extra money to people, they can change the law back when this crisis is over. See, they leave that part out. Now, the New York Times talks about, here's the guy, Henry Knight, Austin, Texas. The possibility that the money might be turned down is a deeply personal issue to Mr. Kite, I should say, K-I-G-H-T. He worked for more than 30 years as an engineering technician. He discovered in September that because of complex state rules in Texas, he was not eligible for unemployment insurance after losing a job at a major electronics manufacturer that he had gotten at the beginning of the year. Unable to draw jobless benefits, it says here, he and his wife have taken on thousands of dollars in credit card debt to make ends meet. Now, it's precisely these kinds of regulations, the ones in the state of Texas, involving the matters like the length of a person's work history or reason for leaving a job, that the feds are trying to get the states to change. And if they will, if they'll change, that could extend benefits to an estimated 500,000 more people, according to an organization called the National Employment Law Project, a liberal group in New York that supports the changes. And Mr. Kite, the guy in Texas, and other unemployed workers said they were incensed to learn they were living in one of a handful of states, many of these states among the poorest in the nation, that might not provide the expanded benefits. Mr. Kite said, quote, it just seems unreasonable that when people need help the most, that because of partisan activity or partisan feelings against the current new administration, Governor Perry is willing to sacrifice the lives of so many Texans that have been out of work in the last year, end quote. He's referring, of course, to Governor Rick Goodhair Perry, who doesn't give a tinker's damn about the people in his state. I'll tell you what's going to happen, and I'm glad to know in my heart of hearts this is going to happen. The Republicans are going to be swept out of just about every office they hold in the 2012 elections. 2010 elections. You watch.
I don't want to sing it all.
Loud, proud, progressive talk. It's Mike Malloy.
Well, my wife returns from taking my little girl to school.
26 before the hour. I'm getting a lot of inquiries about why I'm referring to Governor Jindal as Paiush. Very quickly, that's his goddamn name. What is wrong with you people? His name is not Bobby, it's Paiush Jindal. Remember when Obama was running for office and how everyone insisted, oh, come on, his name is Barack Hussein Obama! Remember all that? I will use the man's real name, Paiush Jindal. People are saying, well, but you're putting kind of a thing on it. Oh, really? What are you hearing? Are you sure that racism thing isn't in your own head? His name is Paiush Jindal. That's what I'll refer to him as, not Bobby. Bobby. Hi, Bobby. His name is Paiush. Back to this the stance some of the southern governors and the governors from a couple of states that are not in the South, Idaho and Alaska, that, by God, we're not going to take that money. No, we want these suckers down here to suffer. If they want, you know, they can go to church. They can pray to Jesus. Jesus will help them. I don't think so. Kelly Joyce, Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, said, I don't understand the whole thing. Apparently, because he has money, referring to Governor Mark Sanford, he has money. He doesn't have to worry about everybody else who doesn't have money. What does he care? South Carolina has the nation's third highest unemployment rate, 9.5%. And the state ruled Kelly Joyce ineligible for benefits for the same reason as Mr. Kite over in Texas, after she lost her job as a marketing assistant in November. This is what they do to you. And the feds are saying, look, these people need help. If you don't want to pay it, okay, we'll do it. Oh, no, we don't want that money down here. Really? Now, here in Georgia, we got the same thing here. New York Times reports on Tuesday, Erica Greer and her mother, Candace Foss, who lost her job as a data management specialist at Home Depot in late January, they came to the state capitol here in downtown Atlanta from Kennesaw, Georgia, a suburb where they live, to deliver a message to Governor Sonny Perdue not to reject any of the stimulus money. Ms. Foss, who's 59, said, quote, I don't think he truly understands the plight of the citizens. He's surrounded by people with good jobs who make good salaries. He's not surrounded by people like me. Well, yeah. If the Republicans have done anything, they don't surround themselves with the people in the military. They even hide their caskets, their corpses coming home. They don't surround themselves with the working people, because, you know, working people are kind of, I don't know, they smell bad. They don't surround themselves with unemployed people because, well, you know, unemployed people have this desperate, grasping look. And these goddamn Republicans are talking about Obama's bill to raise the marginal tax rates on the upper classes, that this constitutes class warfare. These pigs call this class warfare. And as I mentioned last hour, what did they call it when Reagan, who started all this, decided to dump on poor people and give all the and working class people to destroy the middle class? Did they call that class warfare? No!
That was trickle down. That was Reaganomics. That was supply side economics. Yeah, that'll all work out, won't it? How did it work out after 29 years? How's it working? Well, say what you want about Barack Obama, and I have said some things negative and will continue where it concerns his foreign policy until I completely understand his rope-a-dope, apparently, technique. Say what you want. Barack Obama is definitely decided that the wealthy have had a free ride long enough. You bastards. Now you're going to start paying, or they don't listen to this program, they are going to start paying, not even their fair share. Forget that. He's going to raise the tax rate on people who make over $250,000 from, what is it, 36% to 39%. Ooh, Jesus, that's awful. Oh, gosh. The wealthy are not going to be able to afford that. That's people who make over $250,000 a year. Ooh, can't afford that. People make $10, $20, $30, $40, $50 million a year. People that steal, because once you get to this level, you're stealing, $1 billion a year, are going to see their tax rates go up. Ooh. Whiny-ass bastards. So the right-wingers, of course. Oh, that's class warfare. Rush Limbaugh, who makes, what does he make, $25, $30, $40, $50 million a year? He's going to see his tax rate go up. Well, of course he's wedding his rather large bloomers. He didn't want to pay for anything. I don't have to pay for anything. I'm the leader of the Republican Party. These people come to me, just like you do, bobbleheads. Here, put your nose up here so I can suck your brains out. Yeah, listen to the EIB, golden microphone, blah, 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 talent on loan from the devil. Here I am. Anybody got any drugs? And working class, middle class Americans who consider themselves to be conservative, whatever that means, what does that mean? You teach creationism? Follow Limbaugh right over the cliff. And you know, he, if you hesitate, when you get near the cliff, you right wingers, if you hesitate, he kicks your ass over. He likes to see you tumble down into oblivion. He really does.
Oh, there goes another one. How about that?
By the way, Prairie 2 writes in about Maria Bartiromo saying that the first thing over the cliff is going to be charitable contributions, which is horse crap. Prairie 2 writes, the rich are splitting nails over losing part of the deduction for charitable contributions. Oh, God, the poor will suffer. And then the news shows an overworked food bank. See, the super wealthy don't donate to the poor. They donate to the opera. They don't give to homeless people. They give to the art museum. They don't give to unwed mothers. They give to theater groups. The few exceptions to this don't care if they get a tax deduction. Now, the segment of the population that really gives the highest percentage of their income to charity is not the wealthy or the middle class. It's poor people. You know, I've seen time and time again, I'm riding a MARTA train, a commuter train into Atlanta. I especially saw this in Chicago. Chicago is probably a better example. And the subways in New York. Crowded subway car. People got their face buried in their newspapers because all of a sudden all these strangers are too close together and it's very uncomfortable and nobody wants to make eye contact. Okay, one of the stops, doors open, on gets a guy or a woman, and they start giving their pitch. Whether the pitch is true or not is immaterial. They start giving their pitch. You know, I'm unemployed. I desperately need some help. Can you help me? And it's, you know, I usually will throw a dollar in the hat. Just, you know, my mom taught me to do that. But I will watch then as this person works his or her way up and down the train car. The well-dressed people all of a sudden have found very interesting things to look at outside the train or on the advertising cards inside the train or their fingernails. The people who dig in are the ones who are obviously working class. How do you know? You can tell by their clothing. You can tell by the rundown appearance that they make. And I have yet to see very many people of color, especially African-American women, not contribute something, a quarter, 50 cents, a buck, when this comes up. And a few white women. If you're one of those few white women, don't be offended. Don't be offended by what I'm saying right now. But I've seen this over and over and over again. Chicago, New York, Atlanta, it doesn't make any difference. So, you know, all this hand-wringing and sobbing from these wealthy bastards, it's really enough to make you want to
I don't know, just do something radical. Huh? Isn't it something? Listen to them whine. These sons of bitches have been milking us for 30 years! And now when a president of the United States submits a budget that includes raising their taxes from 36% to 39%, they start to whine and bleat and bellyache. You selfish bastards.
Oh, but they pulled themselves up with their bootstraps. Oh, well, you sound like a communist. Oh, well, what do you want to do? Redistribute the wealth.
No. Not at all. I want people who take and take and take and take and take to occasionally give. That's all. No charity. To hell with them. In the form of income tax. That's why wealthy people push this flat tax nonsense, which is a retrograde tax. It slams the working class and poor people and rich people. If it were to ever pass, national sales tax, call it whatever you want. Flat tax, fair tax, it's all garbage. It's what rich people say, well, let's do it this way. Oh, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Let's do away with everything. Put a 17% sales tax on everything and get rid of everything. People should be taxed for spending, not for earning. To the rich people, how many times have they been told, look, you selfish sons of bitches, the price of doing business in a country like this one, where not only can you do whatever you want, you can lay off people, you can move your plants out of the country, you can steal loot, you probably will never, your goddamn corporations have been declared human beings. The price of doing business here, you punks, is to occasionally contribute to the kitty. You think?
Outrage. Oh, here it is. Back to Mike Malloy.
Oh, and by the way, about Piyush Jindal, maybe one of the reasons his state is in the tank where it concerns education, regardless of what Mary Madeline says. Remember back in the summer when there was talk about he might be chosen by McCain to be his running mate for vice president. Remember that? Wouldn't that have been fun? Who sent me this? Well, the folks at Think Progress, Jude sent it. Okay. Hard to keep track of all this. Bobby Jindal, as he likes to call himself, Piyush Jindal, his given name, supports creationism as part of what he called, quote, the very best science, end quote. He was on Face the Nation. he was on Face the Nation right before he was on, or right after, former House Speaker and serial adulterer Newt Gingrich praised Piyush as, quote, spectacular, end quote. And Gingrich said that Piyush would be, quote, far and away the best candidate to be McCain's vice presidential running mate, end quote. Now, just before Gingrich came on to praise him, Jindal himself spoke on Face the Nation, where he invoked conservatives' most hated term, political correctness, to assert that, quote, teachers should teach intelligence design in the classroom. Here's the full quote. This is Piyush. Quote, I don't think students learn by us withholding information from them. I want them to see the best data. I personally think human life and the world we live in wasn't created accidentally. I do think that there's a creator. Now, the way that he did it, I'd certainly want my kids to be exposed to the very best science. I don't want any facts or theories or explanations to be withheld from them because of political correctness. End quote. Paiyush then insisted that the federal and state government should not impose their views on local school districts, which effectively would give school boards, local school boards, carte blanche to teach scientifically inaccurate ideas, just like Kansas did in 2005 when that state rewrote standards to cast doubt on six or seven of the natural sciences. Because when you reject out of your religious madness evolution or the natural selection, you are rejecting, oh my God, paleontology, archaeology, biology. How in the hell can you become a physician or anybody in the medical field if you reject or if you accept the idea of creationism? Does God reach down and keep mutating those little viruses that keep playing hell with human health? Huh? Bunch of idiot freaks. Oh, my God. So Paiyush is also a creationist. And the way they phrase it, you know. Well, I think all of the facts and theories should be taught. Are you saying, Paiyush, that the Judeo-Muslim-Christian idea, this nonsensical belief that a talking snake convinced Eve to bring sin into the world, therefore the bitches are all doomed, right, Paiyush? Do you really want that taught in a science class? You really want it taught that the planet is 6,000 years old? Do you really? Is that well? You answered your own question. You consider that to be on a par in terms of discussion with natural selection, with mutation, with the development or evolution of species. All right. It's just unbelievable stuff. Plus, he's a liar. And isn't this the thing that you find so often with people who tout their religion? I don't care what the religion is. Usually it amounts to fundamentalist Christianity, this creationism garbage. But isn't it true? You usually find that when you dig deep enough, and sometimes you only have to go skin deep, you find a liar. Isn't there something in the commandments about not lying? And here Jindal, who by his words identifies himself as a fundamentalist, a Christian fundamentalist, a dominionist, whatever the hell they're called now, lies. He tells these big whopping stories that go out over national television on all the networks all over the place, and he sits there and lies like a little boy caught in school. Did you do this?
No, ma'am, it wasn't me. I didn't do it.
Isn't that the truth? Time and time and time again.
Well, I didn't have sex with that man.
You didn't?
No. All right, well, maybe a little bit.
On and on and on. All right, we're going to take a break. It is 11 o'clock here in the East, almost. It's Friday, so I'm going to go get a nice glass of Pinot or Cabernet. And if you want to, well, no, we have some more. Don't call in. don't call in. We have some more stuff to cover. So let me go get a glass of wine, and you folks do whatever you want to do. I'll see you back here in a few minutes. I'm Mike Malloy on Second Thought. We'll be right back. 7 past the hour. Oh, yeah, the other thing about Paiyush also is he's an exorcist. An exorcist who lies and wants creationism taught in the public schools. There you go. You got to love this guy, don't you? This is your Republican Party. This guy and the hoe from Wasilla and the drug-addled Limbaugh and Joe, whose name isn't Joe, the plumber who's not a plumber. Oh, my God. And Newt, the serial adulterer Gingrich. Jesus, what a party. Y'all just go ahead, right? Just go ahead. Go ahead. Cat Mary in Memphis writes in that the Tennessee governor, who happens to be a Democrat, Governor Bredesen, is that how you say it, recently said that he may not accept the $141 million stimulus money for Tennessee's unemployment trust. Mary writes, bastard. I called his office and emailed him. Good luck on a reply. Mary goes on to say, as far as stuff to reject in the stimulus, I'm all for eliminating the expensive federal monitoring and databasing of private medical information. As shown by banks, credit card companies, government sites, etc., centralized databases are ripe for hacking and identity theft. The records also could be used to deny people jobs and insurance, as has been done in the past with merely local records. Moreover, Cat Mary writes, the federal monitoring and databasing is aimed at, quote, preventing, end quote, errors in test duplications. Hog snot. The database could only detect problems after the fact, and we already eliminate errors and duplications at the local level. And, Cat Mary writes, moreover, the federal monitoring is aimed at, quote, standardizing medical treatments in a cost-effective manner, end quote. Thus, our autonomy, private decisions, and health freedoms are out the window. What if your condition is atypical? Or you need an experimental treatment, or you need a second or third opinion on your condition. Sorry, those aren't standard. I don't know. I agree with you, Cat Mary, but also the idea of I've got to know more about that. If it's exactly as you say what you're objecting to, yeah, then hell yeah, I'm with you on the objection. But it seems to me that there is a way to reduce the waste and the duplication and the potential for errors, especially in hospitals. So, how many people die because of wrong prescriptions or wrong medicines prescribed for them every year? I'm picking a number out of the air here, but I think I've heard 70,000, 90,000. I mean, that's insanity. So, you know, how do you correct that? I don't know. I don't know. But it has to be corrected somehow. Obama at Camp Lejeune today. I watched this speech, and it was very quiet in there for a while until he started talking about sending troops repeatedly to Iraq. He also made some statements about Afghanistan that I just can't get my arms around or my head around. I don't like what he's saying about Afghanistan. But again, there may be a rope-a-dope element in here that us common liberals or Democrats are just not picking up on yet. I don't know. Maybe not. But I'm still going to go with the man. And I'll tell you what, it happened again today. I listened to what he had to say. And it just, I'm sitting here. Kathy and Molly were gone, and I'm watching this on television. Well, I guess Molly was in preschool. And Kathy was out. So I'm sitting here by myself watching the speech, another speech. And, wow, I just can't get over how much clarity and refusal to be. I don't know. What am I looking for here? Clarity, refusal to just constantly BS the American public, refusal to talk down. He says what he says, and he means what he says, not in the sense of George W. Bush, who was a gibbering maniac, but in the sense of somebody who is, I think, desperately trying to find solutions. Look what was handed to him. Oh, my God. But I digress. He details his plans to remove combat troops from Iraq by August 2010.
As a candidate for president, I made clear my support for a timeline of 16 months to carry out this drawdown, while pledging to consult closely with our military commanders upon taking office to ensure that we preserve the gains we've made and to protect our troops. These consultations are now complete, and I've chosen a timeline that will remove our combat brigades over the next 18 months. So let me say this as plainly as I can. By August 31st, 2010, our combat mission in Iraq will end. As we carry out this drawdown, my highest priority will be the safety and security of our troops and civilians in Iraq. So we will proceed carefully, and I will consult closely with my military commanders on the ground and with the Iraqi government. There will surely be difficult periods and tactical adjustments. But our enemy should be left with no doubt. This plan gives our military the forces and flexibility they need to support our Iraqi partners and to succeed. After we remove our combat brigades, our mission will change from combat to supporting the Iraqi government and its security forces as they take the absolute lead in securing their country.
Okay, now I know what you're thinking, Truth Seeker, because I've been thinking it too.
Wait a minute! What the hell is this 16, 18, 19 months? Wait, just bring them home.
And you and I say that because we have never worked in logistics and supply for the United States military. And to bring home an expeditionary force of this size and all the equipment and all the weaponry, all the temporary and at one time planned by the Bush crime family to be permanent infrastructure, to bring all this home, to get the hell out of this these people's country, is going to take some time. There will also be opportunists who will try to take advantage of an orderly withdrawal. I say the man's been in office for a month. He's got some plans. Let them work. Now, combat. Our combat mission in Iraq will end by August 31st, 2010. So what happens to the 35 to 50,000 left behind?
As I have long said, we will retain a transitional force to carry out three distinct functions: training, equipping, and advising Iraqi security forces as long as they remain non-sectarian, conducting targeted counterterrorism missions, and protecting our ongoing civilian and military efforts within Iraq. Initially, this force will likely be made up of 35,000 to 50,000 U.S. troops. Through this period of transition, we will carry out further redeployments. And under the Status of Forces Agreement with the Iraqi government, I intend to remove all U.S. troops from Iraq by the end of 2011.
Now, those are Marines applauding. Okay, so, you know, to all my brethren and sistren liberals who said withdrawal now, there you have it. Let me say this as plainly as I can. By 31 August 2010, combat mission Iraq will end. By the end of 2011, all U.S. troops from Iraq will be gone.
You know.
Hey, truth seekers, gather round the campfire. It's more Mike Malloy.
You can tell the music changes on this program after I've had a glass of wine, right? Jules in Miami, also known as the Sixth Circle of Hell, writes in, Mike and Kathy, just want to know and let me know if I've had my head up my blank and just not paying attention, but I want to know what your take is on this economic crisis. Specifically, what do you think is going to happen to all of us because of these bastards who have run our country into the ground? Do you think it'll get as bad as Joe Salentin, Nouriel Roubini, Joseph Stiglitz, and other economists say, you know, tax revolts, riots, FEMA camps, etc.? Or do you think the government will be able to stop the hemorrhaging and at least restore some sense of normalcy? Just would like to hear your thoughts on the matter. Well, that's kind of what we do every night, Jules, I guess, but I guess I'm not clear on it. I don't think there's going to be, and this may be wishful thinking rather than, you know, a clear-headed assessment, but I just don't think there's going to be the kind of chaos that some people have predicted. I really don't. There's no question that things are going to be rugged, that there's going to be an awful lot of unemployment, a lot of grief. You know, last week for about, not last week, but what, a couple of weeks ago, for about 16 hours, I was unemployed. The company I worked for went bankrupt. Uh-oh. And luckily, the person in Phoenix who put together a new enterprise here and named it On Second Thought appeared, and we didn't miss a beat. It's going to be rough. It's going to be rough. I don't think, though, Jules, that there's going to be. I don't even think there's going to be demonstrations anymore. And I'll tell you why. If we had a Republican in office, this country would erupt into bloody chaos. I don't doubt that at all, because Republicans don't give a goddamn. They have no ideas. They have no plans. Nothing. Look at these freaks that have clustered at the Shoreham Hotel in D.C. for this conservative political action group, and this obese, large drug addict is going to address them all tomorrow. I mean, it's been a confederacy of dunces without parallel, these freaks. Can you imagine if they were running the country? Then, yes, there would have been bloody hell to pay. But Barack Obama and a good share of his advisors. I realize he has some people around him that a lot of liberals just don't care for. But so far, I mean, the man is taking action on so many fronts. Look what he's been handed. Jules, if you and I were handed something like this, after we both wet our pants, we would run screaming into the woods like, ah, I can't do this. Barack Obama was given an impossible situation to solve. And so far, he is set aside the impossible part of that and is working like a madman to bring solutions. I don't care what happens at this point. I have the deepest respect for this guy. I can't believe, if nothing else, the way he's retained his cool. The way he has walked through this firestorm and continues to offer solutions. Not that
that everybody's going to acknowledge that or take the solutions? Not at all. There are enough people in this country who are just goddamn crazy. They're nutballs. They've had their brains just absolutely destroyed by this right-wing drivel for 30 years. So he's got to overcome that. Not only does Barack Obama have to, and his advisors have to overcome the problems, they've got to overcome the attitudes in this country. For 30 years, the middle class, the working class were told, hey, listen, you're going to get some crumbs. Shut up. Open your mouth. We'll make sure the crumbs sustain you. But we in the upper classes, the upper 5%, we're going to take every goddamn thing that isn't nailed down. And then we're going to go for the stuff that is nailed down. We're going to pry the nails out. We're going to take that, too. And Barack Obama is saying that nonsense is over. So I just wish my liberal brothers and sisters would take a couple of deep breaths here. No, we're not, you know, he's not following our agenda. But you and I are not in charge. I'm not referring to you, Jules. I'm referring to people like me. You know, we're not in charge. So we need to watch, pay close attention, criticize when it's necessary. And by God, there have been moments here when it's been necessary. But give the man a chance. No, I don't think there's going to be chaos in the streets. I really don't.
The new world order. We hold these truths to be self-evident. Well, this is evident, yeah. In the American way, you must get and I shall take. I will tell you what is moral and what's just. Because I want, because I will.
More Flying Monkey Free Fun and Frivolity with Mike Malloy.
It's about 26 before the hour. Now, regarding the, I mentioned this earlier tonight, regarding the Obama administration and the lawsuit regarding state secret. The argument of state secrets privilege exceeds, essentially what it says, exceeds the Fourth Amendment to right to be secure in our persons, places, papers, so on and so forth. In other words, you need a warrant if you're going to come after me. But, you know, the Bush crime family set this deal up where telephones could be tapped and so on and so forth. We could all be spied on. We talked the other night about this court case that was coming up, and that the Obama administration was on the side of retaining the right of the government to wiretap. Here's what it says. The Obama administration has lost its argument that the state secrets privilege is a good enough reason to stop a lawsuit over the government's warrantless wiretapping program. In other words, that's not going to work. The lawsuit is going to go forward. And the Obama administration, on the surface, didn't want it to. A federal appeals court in San Francisco has rejected the Justice Department's request for an emergency stay. The Obama administration, like the Bush administration before it, claimed that national security would be compromised if a lawsuit brought by the U.S. chapter of an Islamic charity was allowed to proceed. The case was brought by a defunct charity with a chapter in Oregon, the Al-Haramain Islamic Foundation. The appeals court decision is a setback for the new Obama administration as it adopts some of the same positions on national security and secrecy as the Bush administration. All right, now that sounds awful, doesn't it? But our friend Spitfire may have come up with an answer. He says, I know that you are already aware of this, but here's my take on it. Well, the truth is, Spitfire, I certainly was not aware of it. But this is what Spitfire writes. In order to reverse the Bush administration policy on, let's call it what it is, spying on Americans, specifically political opponents, as Bush did prior to 9/11. So in order to reverse that policy and to ensure the act was ruled unconstitutional, Obama let the case go forward so that it would lose, thus allowing him to use that ruling to end the policy for himself and future presidents. The way to go, Spitfire. You may have figured out part of the rope-a-dope thing. So it looks to us, to you and me, we liberals, like, oh my God, he's going to continue what Bush did. He said in the campaign, remember we played, or not played, but we showed you the comparison of what he said during the campaign about warrantless wiretapping and yada, yada, yada. And then it appeared like, uh-oh, look what he's doing. He is trying to sustain the Bush policy of warrantless wiretapping. I mean, that's what I thought. That's what my friend Bob Alexander thought. That's what we all thought. But as Spitfire points out, maybe not. Hold on just a second. Maybe the Obama administration, the Eric Holder Justice Department, took the position of, hey, we want to continue to have warrantless wiretapping, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, so that a court would rule. Effectively, not ending the warrantless wiretapping, but ruling that the case can go forward. The case brought against these telecoms for doing it to begin with. So, if the action is ruled unconstitutional, eventually. Now, this court in California can't do that. That's up to the U.S. Supreme Court. But as this thing works its way now through the courts, and it's going to be a long, drawn-out process. It may take a year or two. But as it works its way through the courts, this takes the Obama administration off the hook, where they don't have to come out and say, as we good liberals would like them to say, this has got to stop. Because what would happen if the Obama administration said that? Well, you and I would be thrilled. Oh, we love you, Barack. But the truth is that it would be one more arrow in the quiver for these right-wing animals to attack him. I'm starting to think, I've thought for some time, but it's starting to solidify that maybe, just maybe, Barack Obama is so much smarter than these old white bulls in the House and the Senate, these racist, filthy Republicans, and some racist, filthy Democrats, and some that, yeah, I have to use the word racist on all of them, hell no. But you know, and I know, that a lot of this is a race thing. Come on, come on, get goddamn real. You know it as well as I do. You know it. Now, I'm not talking about the 56 million Americans who voted for him. The vast majority of that number was white. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the people in the Republican Party, which is a party of bigots, racists, homophobes, crazy people, Armageddonists. They are sick. I'm talking about them. So just like Muhammad Ali, rope-a-dope, let the fools flail and beat and attack and wear themselves out until the time comes for Obama to go, boop, and the opposition falls over out cold. I'm going to continue to let myself be educated that maybe Barack Obama and his appointees know a hell of a lot more how to do this than I could possibly imagine. And I'm just asking that if I'm asking anything, it is that maybe, you know, maybe some other liberals who, like, listen to this program might do the same. I don't know. I think it will make for a calmer mental attitude on the part of some of us who, after 8 years, actually 16, actually 20, actually 28 years of this garbage, through three Republican presidents and one Republican light president, we just about reached the end of our ropes, right? I mean, some of us were ready to, I don't know, either commit mass suicide or just go for open insurrection, neither of which makes a goddamn lick of sense, not a bit. So, you know, we've just been like poised, like, let's get the Democrat, let's get the liberal in there. Oh, my God, now do something. Well, maybe he is doing something, but something that it's going to take liberals like you and me a few moments to absorb, if not longer. You understand what I'm saying? I'm sure you do. Now, regarding the possibility of riots in the streets and so on and so forth, Prairie 2 writes, and I agree with your view of the future, if nothing bizarre happens or China dumps us or something I haven't thought of, the longer Obama is in charge, the better our chances are. He is literally running the government on a skeleton crew, since people who know what they are doing are hard to come by, and K Street types, the lobbyists, need not apply. At the same time, he has to rebuild government from the ashes. Then there's the coming stock market crash, the very real possibility that the dollar may cease to be an international currency. Oh, and Dick Cheney with his nukes. Yeah, there are some real possibilities. Tom in Minneapolis, you cut Obama too much slack, but time will tell. Well, yeah, and the reason, I'm not cutting him any slack at all. I'm not compromising anything that I personally, just me and my little teensy-eensy millimeter of the universe that I believe in. Not a bit. All I'm and I don't expect you to, Tom, or anybody to. You know, if you're a liberal or a socialist or a leftist or somebody that believes in democratic socialism like I do, he's not doing everything I want him to do. You know, I want the goddamn banks to be abandoned. Let the sons of bitches die. Just walk away. Turn around and walk away. I hate that part. But maybe Obama and his advisors know something that I don't have a clue about. The real chaos that might ensue. I don't know. I have no idea. I want Barack Obama to pull every troop out of Iraq and Afghanistan tomorrow, even while I understand that that is logistically impossible. It can't be done. No one can do it. The only way it might be done is if we still fought our wars on horseback. Then you make everybody saddle up, break camp, and get the hell out of town. That's not how it works. So, yeah, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Sure, I understand, but I'm going to stick it out. I really am. And I guess that's all I'm suggesting to all you liberals, bless your hearts out there. We got to bite the bullet, too. We don't have to bite the bullet the way these rich bastards who just want to continue to bleed us dry. We've got to bite the bullet the other way. And that is, give the man time. Give him time. Support him. Give him time. Criticize him, but give him time.
See the way they turned his dream around. I've gotta go by what he told me. Try to tell the truth and stand your ground. Don't let the bastards get you down.
Ten before the hour, thanks to the crew, Ian Huff, Ben Burt, Sharon Gordy, Bob Alexander, Richard Wolf, Bruce Enberg. Kathy Bay is our executive producer. Mike in Roswell, New Mexico. Michael writes regarding the conclusion, Spitfire's conclusion, that this is Barack Obama's way of rope-a-doping the opposition where it concerns illegal wiretapping. Michael writes, sorry, wrong. The state secrets privilege is unrelated to wiretapping. It was established by the Supreme Court in 1953 and is the ruling that says, in essence, that when the privilege is invoked, the state secrets privilege is invoked, the level of secrecy is such that national interests would be harmed and that those interests take precedent over any individual claims against the government. Therefore, the invocation of the privilege, in exactly the same way as the Bush administration, was truly meant to shut down the trial. If the Obama administration wanted to see that the court followed through and let the case proceed in order to expose Bush wrongdoing during discovery, it would have refrained from invoking the privilege. When queried by the judge in the case about any changes in the government's stance on privilege with the change in administration, the Department of Justice lawyers indicated that no, the government's position with regard to privilege was the same as the Bush administration's. In fact, this is consistent with Obama's vote on the so-called Protect America Act. Michael in Roswell. Okay. Okay. So we move on to round two. Michael, I've just got to believe. I cannot believe. Not yet. It may come to that. But, maybe I've drunk the Kool-Aid where it concerns the Obama administration. But I cannot yet believe that this guy wants to continue any of the Bush policies where it concerns these types of issues. I don't know. We'll see. And Jude writes in, most of you know that James Dobson has retired as chairman of Focus on the Family, right? He's the one that said with the election of Barack Obama, he more or less gives up because Barack Obama is a pro-abortion person, which he's not. Nobody is pro-abortion unless they're insane. All of us are against abortion, even the people who lobby desperately for a woman's right to privacy. We just believe in stopping abortion other ways, like contraception, like family planning situations, like educating our children on the proper way to not get pregnant if you're going to have sex. And, you know, God knows that teenagers can be talked out of sex just like that, huh? Anyway, Dobson, this crazy old bastard, is retiring. And that's the good news. Here's the bad news. The new head of Focus on the Family is to be a retired Air Force Lieutenant General, Patrick Corona. So now, Jude writes, a retired military lieutenant general has direct connection with millions of Christian fundamentalists. Well, you know what the old hymn says, Jude, onward Christian soldiers, right? It gets, as Alice said, curiouser and curiouser. Dick is calling from Seattle, who listens on KPTK. Dick, welcome to the program. Hi.
Well, yeah, Mike, I wanted to talk about an unfortunate experience I had a couple of nights ago.
Can you do it in 2 minutes?
I'll try. Turned on ABC's History Channel.
Yeah.
I happened to catch them lying through their teeth on one of their multi-million-dollar productions covering up our last great populist Democratic president John Kennedy's murder. So since I've heard this particular lie so often, I thought I'd expose it and expose them for what they are. Now, their whole case here is built around this 161 grain weight magic bullet allegedly.
Wait, Dick.
Yeah.
You want to talk about the Kennedy assassination?
Yeah, well, no. This I'm talking about a major ABC network lying through their
okay,
teeth.
Okay, but you know, you're the last caller. We've got about a minute left, and I don't know.
It's a major lie, Mike.
Okay, I understand
major
that.
Major crime. Major lie.
I understand. I don't doubt it, but I don't think. I don't think that that anybody right now tonight on this program really wants to get into that. I mean, I'm right there with you. I agree. I'm 100% in your corner, Dick. I'm just saying, we've got 40 seconds left on the program, and I'm just going to have to, to cut you off right at the point you're in what you're trying to say, where everything is going to be like, oh, Jesus, what was that last minute and a half about? I'm sorry, man. I don't want to talk about the weight of the bullets that killed Kennedy. I'm there with you. I believe everything about the Kennedy assassination is a lie. But, okay, no offense, man. I'm not trying to be a creep with you or anything of the sort. I really am not. But you know, now we're down to about 20 seconds when the music starts and we have to boogie. But no, this is, you know, some night, well, maybe we'll talk about the Kennedy assassination. I touch on it occasionally just as another example of, you know, of the lies that we've been told, just like Vietnam, like Kennedy, like Bay of Pigs, like Iran-Contra, like the 9/11 attack, you know. Okay, no offense, Dick. I don't mean to do that. All right, we're just about out of here. Thanks everybody for hanging out tonight and all this week. Very strange business. We're really in it up to our chin. I hope we all learn to tilt our head back so we can continue to breathe and not have water pour into our lungs until this administration or you and me or whomever get a handle on this stuff, okay? So in that vein, take care over the weekend, right? Relax. Try to relax.
Goddamn it, relax!
Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is on Second Thought Radio Network. He always relaxes, so have a great weekend wherever you are, Kevin Kinney.